Okay, first we begin with homage to Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, today is April 7th, 2012. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, I have a few announcements to make before we start the class. If you've looked at the schedule, you see that there is a big gap between today's class and the next class. Today is April 7th. The next class is really far off. It's May 12th. The reason for this is that coming up in the next 2 weeks here, we're starting next Friday, there'll be a 10-day meditation course taught by the abbot's mother, who comes from Malaysia. So that will take 2 Saturdays. The Saturday after that, I have a meeting of our Buddhist Cultural Relief Organization. And the week after that, that is May 5th, I was invited to give a lecture at the Vaisak celebration of the various Buddhist temples in the Hudson Valley. If anybody is interested in attending this, I'll give the name of the place where it'll take place and the address. I should mention that Vaisak is the day that celebrates, in the Theravada tradition, the birth, the enlightenment, and the passing away of the Buddha. It's usually the full moon day of May, or close to the full moon day. Okay, so this will be a celebration of the Buddha's birth and enlightenment, bringing all the various temples and monasteries in the Hudson Valley will be collaborating on this, and it will be held at a place called, hold your seat, the Temple of All-Encompassing Great Compassion. So just to be encompassed by that great compassion might be worth the trip in itself. And the address is 12 Edmund, like the man's name, Edmunds Lane, Walden, like the famous book by Henry David Thoreau, Walden, New York, 12586. And it starts at 9:30 a.m. and will continue through about 4:30 in the afternoon. And everybody is welcome. Whether you live in the Hudson Valley or not, doesn't matter. Okay, so the next class that we'll have will be on May 12th. And now, since this is the time of Vaisak, you know, usually the whole month of May is considered the Vaisak month. And I was thinking to do something that we've actually never done here. And this is, if anybody who has been studying Buddhism for some time feels that they want to make the commitment of, now I'm not going to ordain as monks, to make the commitment of taking the 3 refuges and the 5 precepts, we will have a little ceremony on May 12th for that event. Is there anybody who would be interested in that who's here now? Okay. Now, what happens when you do the going for refuge, what it means is that you, in a sense, you dedicate yourself or commit yourself to following the Buddha's path. You take the 3 refuges, it means that you look upon the Buddha as your supreme spiritual teacher, You take the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, as your guide to the right understanding and right practice of life. And then you take refuge in the Sangha, the community of the committed and wise followers of the Buddha, as your guides and helpers on the path. And then you take the five precepts, which are the precepts to abstain from the destruction of life, from taking the belongings of others, from sexual misconduct, false speech, and the use of intoxicants. So even if you don't feel ready right now to raise your hand, but if you're interested, you can contact me. I give my email address. It's Ven, V-E-N, like Venerable, Bodhi, B-O-D-H-I, @gmail.com. And so we will have it on May 12th. Maybe we'll finish the class a little bit early at 11 o'clock. Then we will do the ceremony at 11 o'clock. Okay, so everybody now has the handout, and so we will now continue with the study of Sutta number 70 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Kitagiri Sutta. And in the sutta, which we took the first part last week, the sutta begins when the Buddha travels to this place called Kitagiri, and he reproaches the monks who are living there for breaking the precept of taking food after midday. Explained as one of the monastic practices, and these monks were not following the Buddha's advice on that. And so the Buddha traveled and he criticized them for that. And then he gave them an analysis of feelings, and we went through that analysis of feelings. And so that takes us up to page 580. Don't worry if you don't have the book, because pretty much what I'm going to cover is on the handout sheet. Okay, so that takes us up to page 580, paragraph 11, section 11. And here the Buddha is introducing what seems to be a new theme. He's speaking about a distinction that he makes between monks who still have work to do with diligence and monks who have no more work to do with diligence. Why do you think the Buddha would introduce this topic in relation to the monks that he's been speaking to? How does that theme fit into the structure of the sutta? Bob?
Well, it's a way of suggesting to the monks that he's just criticized that they do have work to do.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, they're being heedless or negligent, not being diligent. And so the Buddha wants to say, he's going to analyze the different classes of even noble or partly enlightened disciples, and he'll say, even they have work to do with diligence. So you, who are still relative beginners on the path, how much more do you have to work with diligence? Okay, so now the Buddha makes this distinction. Some monks still have work to do with diligence, and that key word is appamāda, and there are monks who have no more work to do with diligence. I put this word on the board last week. Thank you. Yeah, appamāda, it's a negation of the word pamāda. Pamāda means negligence, heedlessness, carelessness, sloppiness. And it's opposite, appamāda, diligence or heedfulness. As I said last week, it's a kind of combination of effort, mindfulness, and being conscientious, making an effort mindfully in order to be conscientious in one's practice. Okay, so first, the Buddha is going to introduce the monks who have no more work to do with diligence. And now he says, I do not say of those monks who are arahants, who have destroyed or eliminated the taints, or the difficult word to translate, the asavas, which mean, he calls them mental pollutants or mental contaminants. Or some render this as influxes, things that flow into the mind and corrupt and pollute the mind. Okay, so these are the arhats who have destroyed the mental pollutants, who have lived, fully lived the spiritual life, done what had to be done, who completed the practice, laid down the burden of suffering, who have reached the goal, who have destroyed the fetters or bonds that keep them bound to the cycle of birth and death, and who are completely liberated through perfect or final knowledge. So the Buddha says they don't have any work to do with diligence. And why is that? Because they have already completed their work. So they're no more capable of being negligent. So the arahants are the ones who are fully liberated, fully awakened, fully purified. And in the past, they were extremely diligent, practiced very earnestly, and through their practice, they progress through the different stages. They eliminated all ignorance and spiritual blindness, and so they've awakened to the Four Noble Truths, cut off all defilements, and freed themselves from the cycle of birth and death. But now the Buddha speaks about those monks who still have work to do with diligence, and now he's speaking of those monks. And here, when we use the word monks, of course he's speaking to the monks, but he could be referring to nuns, lay people, laymen, laywomen, who are still in training, what's called the higher training. These are the disciples called seka. Comes from the verb sikati, which means to train, to learn, to practice. And so the sekas are those who are in the training, but they've already advanced to a level where we say they're in the higher training, since they've stepped into the stream of the Dhamma. They've gained certainty of ultimate realization. But they have not yet reached the goal. Okay, so the Buddha describes them that these are monks who are in the higher training, whose minds have not yet reached the goal, and who are still aspiring for supreme security from bondage. In other words, they're still aspiring to gain complete liberation. But they've reached a point where they are inwardly assured that they will reach liberation, because they've gained the essential knowledge or come into conformity or harmony with the truth of the Dharma. Also, the Buddha says that these monks still have work to do with diligence. And why is that? Because when these venerable ones... Did I go through this last week? I did. I thought it sounded familiar. I'm sorry. But we have new people, so doesn't hurt to review. Because when these venerable ones make use of suitable resting places and associate with good friends and nurture their spiritual faculties, they might realize the goal for themselves right here and now. Okay, so seeing this fruit of diligence for these monks, I say they still have work to do with diligence. Okay. Anyway. I'm going to come to these formulas, so don't worry about it. Yeah, I'm just coming to that now. Okay, so now the sort of the Buddha makes this distinction of the two types: the arhats who have completed their work, and the trainees who are still practicing to realize the goal. And now he's going to introduce a more detailed classification of the noble ones into seven types of persons. So first he just introduces the names, the designations. The one liberated in both ways, the one liberated by wisdom, the body witness, the one attained to view, to right view, the one liberated by faith, a Dhamma follower, and a faith follower. So you could say that this is like the table of contents. And now the Buddha is going to give the explanations of each type one by one. And he's going in this sutta, he's going from the highest down to the lowest. So the first one is called, and what we're going to meet first is an analysis or division of the arahats, the liberated ones, into two types, two subtypes. The first is the one liberated in both ways. It's on the sheet in Pali, Ubhato Bhagavimutto. Then we have the explanation or definition. Here, some person contacts with the body and abides in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial or formless, transcending forms, transcending material forms, and his taints or his defilements are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This kind of person is called one liberated in both ways. Okay, we have two parts in this definition, which is intended to bring out the meaning of the both ways in which he's liberated. So first, it's said that this person contacts with the body, kayena pusitva, and dwells in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. First, what is meant by these liberations that are immaterial and peaceful? I think I referred to them last week, 2 weeks ago. Okay, we have the four jhanas. The four jhanas are not the liberations that are peaceful, transcending form. Excuse me?
Insight?
No. The four jhanas, these are four stages of samadhi, four stages of concentration of mind, where the mind becomes very deeply absorbed in the object so that it's not aware of the external world, but the mind becomes filled with joy and bliss and tranquility and radiance. And there are four levels of jhana, of meditative absorption, each going deeper than the other. But within the jhana, the meditator still has some kind of mentally visualized form as the object. And so it's still said that the four jhanas, even though they're very lofty states, but they still belong to the realm of forms. But beyond the four jhanas, there are four other stages of mental concentration. These are not yet states of wisdom or insight, but just stages of deep meditative absorption, where the mind becomes very tranquil, very collected and focused, very peaceful. So beyond the four jhanas, there's a state called the sphere of infinite space. Beyond that, a meditation called the sphere of infinite consciousness. Beyond that, a meditation called the sphere of nothingness. Then beyond that, a meditative state called the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. We don't have to worry about examining these in detail now. And these are not stages of real liberation in the sense of liberation from samsara, the realm of birth and death. They're just stages of absorbing and concentrating the mind. Eliminating, you might say, the diversity or multiplicity of ordinary mental functions and activities, and collecting the mind so that it's all brought, the mind is brought into one unified, focused mass of bliss, peace, tranquility. In the formless states, even bliss subsides and there's peace, tranquility, motionless equanimity. And so these states are said to transcend forms. Okay, so that is called one kind of liberation. It's not the liberation from birth and death, the cycle of rebirths, but it's a liberation from, let's say, from the constrictions or confinements of an undeveloped mind. It's a liberation from being tied down to the world of forms and ordinary activities. But beyond that is the deeper liberation, which is the liberation through wisdom. And that is the liberation that is achieved when wisdom eliminates, completely eliminates the taints, the pollutants, the bonds of the mind. And so a person who is able to enter into these formless meditations and to dwell in them is said to be liberated in one respect. And then when this person is also gains the wisdom to cut off the bonds of birth and death, then he's liberated through wisdom in the other respect. And when the text uses this expression that the person contacts with the body these peaceful liberations, this has to be understood in a metaphorical sense. It doesn't mean that one experiences the formless meditations with the physical body, but the way I understand it, it's a meditative experience which is so powerful that it's as if one is experiencing with the body. You know, it's experienced very deeply, very intimately. And so the person can experience them and dwell in them for extended periods of time, even for a few hours, perhaps even for a whole day or several days. And when we sit, we get pain in the legs here, we have to change the position, or get up and stretch or walk. But this person has been, you know, trained so well in this practice that they could sit for hours and sometimes days on end. Okay, so the Buddha then speaks about this kind of person who is an arahat, one fully liberated, as one who has no more work to do with diligence because this person has already done the work with diligence. Okay, the second type of noble person here is also an arhat, but this arhat doesn't have the power of concentration developed to the same degree as the first one. So this person is called one liberated by wisdom. Here the text says, here some person does not contact with the body and dwell in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms, but his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. This one, this kind of person is called one liberated by wisdom. Okay, so the point here is that this person might be able to achieve the four jhanas, the four lower meditative absorptions, but the person cannot achieve or doesn't make the effort to achieve the formless meditations.
It's vipassana, insight meditation.
Well, insight meditation is what leads to wisdom. So both the one liberated in both ways and the one liberated by wisdom have to get liberated. They have to develop vipassana or insight. But you say that the one liberated by wisdom puts more emphasis on insight or vipassana, whereas the one liberated in both ways, you say, probably has an equal balance of vipassana and samadhi, insight and concentration. Okay, so the one liberated by wisdom can develop the four jhanas, the four meditative absorptions, but this person doesn't reach the formless meditations. But even though this person doesn't reach the formless meditations, through the power of insight, the power of wisdom, he's seen into the truth and thereby eradicated all of the defilements, the asavas, the pollutants. And so this person is also an arhat, fully liberated. And so this person too, the Buddha says, has no more work to do with diligence. Okay, so these are the two fully liberated ones, the two arhats. Okay, now we come to a group. The next persons on the list fall into a group. Here we have to get a little bit technical. But you, those of you who have been coming regularly to the class will know these terms. We speak about four, usually the texts speak about four stages of enlightenment, four stages of realization. The stage of arhat, non-returner, once-returner, and stream-enterer. Okay, the person at this stage, will make it simple. These three stages to come next can be either stream-enterers, once-returners, or non-returners, or those on the definite path to those stages.
On the book? Yeah.
No, the three that come in the middle. Body witness, the one attained to view, the one liberated by view. This is in paragraphs 17, 18, and 19. So these three are the ones who are in the training, deeply in the training. They've not yet reached the goal. And this gets a little complicated, but just have to follow the logic. We have the three, the body witness, the one attained to view, the one liberated by view. These three can be at any of the three levels: non-returner, once-returner, or stream-enterer. We can't tell which level they will be at because they can be at any of these three levels. It's a different way of classifying. When we have the three stages, stream-enterer, once-returner, non-returner, those are stages of progress. The stream-enterer is the one who has just really gotten into the stream of the Dhamma, bound to gain liberation in seven lives at most. The once-returner has cut off more defilements and so will come back to this world only one more time and then reach the final goal. The non-returner doesn't come back to this world, but will take rebirth in one of the higher realms and achieve liberation there. So those are three stages distinguished by way of progress, who is more advanced by who. So if we ask, who is more advanced, the non-returner or the stream enterer, what is the answer?
Non-returner.
Right, the non-returner. Who's more advanced, the once-returner or the non-returner? Right, the non-returner. So the stream-enterer is a little bit like, say, the adolescent. let's say 14 years old. The once-returner, like 18 years old. The non-returner, like maybe a 21-year-old person. The arhat is like the mature adult, you know, 67. Okay, but the body witness can be either a stream enterer, once returner, non-returner. One attained to view can be either once a non. Can be the stream enterer, once returner, non-returner. One liberated by faith can be either stream enterer, once returner, non-returner. So these three are distinguished not by degree of progress, but rather by what?
The jhana they can go into.
It doesn't actually speak about jhana, but what are they distinguished by?
Defilement.
It doesn't mention defilements.
The faculties.
Exactly. Very good. Distinguished by their faculty. And which faculty we'll see as we go into the definition. Okay, let's take now back to the text. We take the body witness. Okay, so what kind of person is the body witness? Here, some person contacts with the body and dwells in those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. Okay, so this person, from this we could tell what is their strong faculty. Sandy could tell us.
I distracted
her. Yeah. What is a strong faculty?
You mean the body witness?
Okay. Yeah. What are the spiritual faculties?
Concentration.
Okay, that is a strong... Okay. But let's get all of the faculties. Who can give us all of the faculties? Did you have your hand?
Faith. Energy.
Right.
Mindfulness.
Okay, very good. So faith, energy or effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And in the case of the body witness, we see that this person can reach these very deep levels of samadhi, of concentration. So their strong faculty is the faculty of concentration. So this person can attain the formless liberations, can experience them very deeply, as if with the body. And some of his taints, only some, not all, are destroyed by seeing with wisdom. So that's why the person is partly liberated, not yet fully liberated. So this kind of person is called the body witness. And you see, the body witness is called the body witness because this person has that very powerful experience of the deep meditative states. So it's with this, metaphorically, with the body, with the whole person, you could say that this person can get into these deep states of meditative tranquility. But the Buddha says, I say of this person that he still has work to do with diligence. And why is that? Because when he makes use of suitable dwelling places, associates with good friends, and nurtures the spiritual faculties, then he can reach the final goal. Okay, so this is the body witness, the one strong in concentration. Okay, now we come to the next. This is called the person who is attained to view. Ooh, we didn't have the right font. Okay, we're in your sheet where you see these strange characters there. It should be a T with a dot under it. Ditti, ditti patta. Okay, and what is meant by view here? It's not simply a view like an opinion or a point of view, but it's really insight, or the insight of wisdom, or the wisdom of insight, seeing the truth, a person who has seen the truth for himself. Okay, so what kind of person is one attained to view? Here, some person does not contact with the body and dwell in those peaceful and formless liberations. But some of his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. The person uses wisdom, like all of them uses wisdom, to destroy the taints partly, not completely. And then this indicates, what comes next will indicate the special strength of this person. And this person has reviewed and examined with wisdom the teachings or dhammas proclaimed by the Tathagata, that's the Buddha. So this kind of person is called one attained to view. Okay, so from this we can see what is the strong faculty of this person, of the five faculties. Wisdom. So all of these disciples use wisdom to eliminate the taints or defilements. That's necessary. You see, that comes in the description of all of them. But the special feature of this kind of disciple is that this person uses their wisdom to examine, say, the teachings or principles taught by the Buddha. So he makes special use, you could say maybe of intellectual effort first, to examine and reflect on the teachings, to get them very clear in the mind, conceptually, and then puts a lot of emphasis on developing insight wisdom in order to understand many principles through direct insight.
So because this person places extra emphasis on wisdom, maybe they don't have to develop concentration to a very high degree.
In all of these seven types of noble ones, where they all, I guess, assume possess the fifth faculty, it's a given.
Yeah, all of them possess the five faculties, but it's a matter of emphasis, or what one places the emphasis on, or what is the strong faculty in a person's character. Okay, now we come to the third one in this group, and this is called the person. I have to say the Pali name is a little strange. I don't know why it has this name. It's called one liberated by faith. But the strange thing is, why I say that this name is a little strange, because the person isn't really fully liberated yet. Maybe only just partly liberated. And so we say that the person is called liberated by faith. But what this means is that the strong faculty of this person is the faculty of faith. So this person is explained in this way in the sutta. So what kind of person is one liberated by faith? Okay, here some person does not contact with the body and abide in deliberations that are peaceful and formless, and so on. But some of his taints are destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. You see, even the one who emphasizes faith still has to use the wisdom to eliminate the defilements in part. But now comes the strong point of this person. For this person, his faith is planted, rooted, and established in the Tathagata, that is, in the Buddha. So this kind of person is called one liberated by faith. And then the Buddha says, this one also has work to do with diligence. Okay, so this, the way I understand it, this person, sort of his motive for undertaking the practice of the path has been his faith in the teaching, his personal devotion towards the Buddha. And so we could see like a distinction between the one attained to view would be the kind of person who says, I'm not going to believe anything until I've examined it closely. I don't go for this devotional and emotional stuff. I'm a hard-headed guy with a mind like a chisel. You know, you give me something, I'm going to test it, beat it, hammer it, till it stands up. So that person uses that faculty, and then when he hears, learns the teaching, he examines them, you know, questions, probes, reflects, till his understanding gets really clear. The one liberated by faith is probably the one who is initially inspired by like beautiful, if he sees the Buddha in person, by the physical form of the Buddha, or in later generations, maybe by beautiful Buddha images. He likes chanting, devotional services. So the person is stirred and inspired and uplifted by that feeling of faith and devotion. But if he thinks that he can just settle for faith and devotion, it's not enough, is it? Why not?
Would that be considered a lay person, more or less, would you say?
It's not really, the distinction isn't made here between a lay person and a monk. The Buddha is speaking actually in terms of monks here. Yeah. Well, you haven't been in an Asian Buddhist country. I'd say maybe 80% of the monks fall into the category of sort of leaning to the side of being Saddhavimutta. You know, when I was in the U.S., I mean, before I went to Asia to become a monk, you know, reading the books on Theravada Buddhism, I thought that, well, when I get to Sri Lanka, all of these Buddhists are going to be like, or the monks will be like Bertrand Russell with shaved heads and saffron robes. You know, Bertrand Russell was like the great British empiricist, logical empiricist philosopher. Or like David Hume, you know, the founder of British empiricism, with shaved heads and yellow robes. You read Walpole Rahula, What the Buddha Taught, Piyadasi Tara, The Buddha's Ancient Path, Narada, The Buddha and His Teachings. You think Theravada Buddhism, very rational, very intellectual. So you think you could stop any Buddhist on the street and say, what do you think of dependent origination? What? How about the Four Noble Truths? What are the Four Noble Truths? But you go into the temple with the Bodhi tree, they can recite, you know, eight, how's it called? Jaina Pujitaya. Do you remember that one? Imeyete Mahabodhi Dhammarajena Pujita. I worship these Bodhi tree, this Bodhi tree, worshipped by the Buddha, the king of the Dharma, and so on. Yeah, so within the living Buddhist tradition, there is, you know, a lot of emphasis on faith and devotion. Okay, but the point I was making, if the person thinks they can just fall back on faith and devotion, what's a Buddha or a teacher going to say to them?
Work on wisdom.
Yeah, exactly. That faith, it's not enough. You need wisdom. So what? And to get the wisdom, of course, you have to develop concentration. So you have to work on concentration and wisdom. So the person, you could say, is motivated strongly by faith, but in order to reach the stage where he can eliminate some of the defilements, he has to develop concentration and wisdom. And it's wisdom that removes the defilements. Okay, I'm going to move on, and I want to finish all seven persons, then we'll throw open the door to questions, and I'll also ask a few questions to test you guys. Okay, now those three persons that we just covered, the body witness, one attained to view, one liberated by faith, they can be either stream enterer, once returner, non-returner. Any of those three can be at any of those three stages. The difference between body witness, attained to view, liberated by faith. The body witness has the strongest concentration or samadhi. The one attained to view has the strongest wisdom, panya or prajna. And the one liberated by faith has the strong faith or saddha. Now, there are two other types of persons who are on the path to stream entry. These disciples have, you could say they're on the bank, we might say. They're about to fall into the stream, but they haven't hit the water yet. But they are, it's like somebody who has jumped off a diving board. You know, there's no way that person can get back onto the diving board. He's going down in, you know, let's say there's a diving board, not a swimming pool, but there's a river flowing by. And the person, I've seen these, they do exist. So person has climbed up the diving board, jumped off, he's heading to the stream. He hasn't gotten to the stream yet, but you could say, you know, there's no question of placing bets that person's going to hit the stream. It's just gravity is pulling him down to the river and he's going to hit it and get into the stream. So there are two people like this, two persons of that category that fall into that class. Okay, one of these is called the Dhamma follower. So this person does not contact with the body, the formless or peaceful liberations, and he hasn't yet destroyed any of the taints with wisdom, but he has accepted through reflection and with wisdom, with sufficient wisdom, he has accepted the teachings or dhammas proclaimed by the Tathagata. And moreover, he has these qualities. That is, he has the five faculties: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. These faculties are still weak in him, not yet well developed, but this person has the five faculties. And he has a particular strong point. And what is the strong point of this person? What is it that sort of leads them to the stream? Speak a little loudly.
Wisdom?
Exactly. It's the wisdom is sort of the leading faculty for this person. And now contrast this with the next person. This is the person called the faith follower. Again, this person doesn't contact with the body and dwell in the formless meditations. He hasn't yet destroyed any of the taints with wisdom, and yet he has sufficient faith in and love for or devotion toward the Buddha, the Tathagata. And also he has the five faculties. He has faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. They're still somewhat weak, but he has these five faculties. These five faculties have started to sprout within him. So this kind of person is called a faith follower. Okay, so what is the strong faculty for this person? Okay, faith. So we see here the Dhamma follower, the faith follower, are both at the same level. They don't attain the formless meditations. They haven't yet eliminated any of the defilements with wisdom. They both have the five spiritual faculties. The text doesn't say this, but they're both bound to enter the stream. But one of them, the Dhamma follower, gives precedence to understanding the Dhamma. This one reflects on the teachings of the Buddha. He examines them with wisdom and he comes to accept them sort of deeply through wisdom, to the point where the person, that wisdom develops to the point where the person comes into harmony with the Dhamma. He hasn't yet broken through to this insight into the truth yet, but he's come into harmony. He's brought his understanding into harmony with the Dharma. Okay, the faith follower apparently doesn't develop the wisdom as sharply as the Dhamma follower. But this person has such strong faith, and that faith will motivate this person to develop the five faculties to the point where he still has enough wisdom to be assured, enough wisdom to come into harmony with the Dhamma, so that he's bound to enter the stream. He's jumped off the diving board. He's coming down, down, down towards the water. Maybe because Buddhism emphasizes wisdom, so maybe we could say that the Dhamma follower is like three quarters down towards the water. The faith follower is maybe halfway down towards the water. But whether you're three quarters of the way down, halfway down, if you've jumped off that diving board, you is going to hit that water. Whether in a tenth of a second or a twentieth of a second, you'll be all wet. And if you just let yourself flow, you'll be carried along by the stream. Okay, so now we've covered the seven persons. And now let's try to find out, to figure out some connections between these persons. We'll start at the bottom. Okay, when the faith follower is now on the path to stream entry, when the faith follower becomes a stream enterer, let me do it, we'll take it the easier ones first, then take more difficult ones. We'll start with the Dhamma follower. When the Dhamma follower moves from the path to stream entry to the attainment of stream entry, how will that person wind up normally? Which, in what category will that person wind up?
One return?
Will be one. No, you're not on the...
One attained to view.
One attained to view, correct. And why does the Dhamma follower wind up as one attained to view? Yeah, yeah. Because they both give emphasis to wisdom. Now, when the one attained to view progresses further to the stage of arhatship, what is the great, what kind of arhat will they probably wind up as? Right, very good. Yeah, as one liberated by wisdom. Because all three of them put emphasis on wisdom. Okay, now the faith follower, when the faith follower develops further and moves to the stage of when becomes a stream enterer or a once returner or a non-returner, how will they wind up generally?
Liberated by faith.
By one liberated by faith. That's the tendency. Okay, when one liberated by faith advances further and becomes an arahat, where do they wind up?
It could be either or.
Good, good. I think he said it. What is your name?
Sam. But yeah, because they could end up either way.
Okay. There's a microphone here, so we'll pass it around so that the voices gets amplified better.
Do you really want me to repeat?
Yeah. No, you got the right answer, so might as well share it.
They could end up either way because of their faith. They have faith in the meditation and also the teaching.
Yeah. It seems that they could wind up either way. But what's interesting is that there's... This is why I say it's a little misleading. There's no third arhat called one, how would we call this? One absolutely liberated by faith or completely liberated by faith. The one liberated by faith isn't yet really liberated. So when this person goes on to arhatship, you know, they have to choose one or the other. And so it seems if they're going to put more emphasis on developing the concentration, the samadhi, to the point they get the formless meditations, then they wind up in arhat. I'm sorry, they wind up one liberated in both ways. But if they start to put more emphasis on insight and wisdom without putting so much emphasis on samadhi, then they'll wind up as one liberated by wisdom.
question about it. Are they both equal, the one liberated in both ways?
Okay, take the microphone.
Are they both equal, the one liberated in both ways, and one liberated by wisdom, or is the other one higher than?
As far as liberation in the ultimate sense goes, they are both equal. They both have completed the work of developing the path. It's just that the one liberated in both ways has stronger samadhi or mental concentration. But as far as eliminating all of the asavas or the defilements through wisdom, they're both the same. So the ultimate goal for the Buddha's practice is that liberation through elimination of the asavas or the taints. So in that respect, they're equal. Now what's interesting question, we have on the path to stream entry, the two types of followers, we've seen one emphasizes wisdom, one emphasizes faith, and at the stage of those already on the who have gained some realization, we have three types. Now this is the question. You know, in the Buddha's time, there were yogis and sages and munis, different types of ascetics, sannyasis, who were practicing meditation deep in the forests and in the mountains, who are already skilled in these formless meditations. Now, it's a puzzling question. When they come to the Buddha's teaching, many of them do, they already have these attainments, and then they start practicing, and some of them, certainly, they'll get onto the path to stream entry. So there's not a third category. We should have a Dhamma follower, faith follower, and how do we call this? Samadhi follower? But why isn't there? Why not?
Because of mindfulness?
Okay. Answer? Use the microphone for the answer.
Is it because of mindfulness, their wrong view on the teachings? They practice samadhi.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Okay.
Okay,
so let's just take your answer. Because they have the wrong view. Okay, anybody else have an answer? Go away, you look like you were going to answer.
I think taints are not destroyed.
Well, for none of them, the taints are destroyed, so they're all in the same boat in that respect.
My guess is when one has faith, it's similar to when person has a focused mind, and it's similar to concentration. So I would think those people who attain formless stage of meditation belong to the category of faith follower.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. Anybody else have any idea?
Well, the concentration would be the body witness, but the body witness has what I think, you know, the samadhi follower wouldn't, which is enough wisdom to remove taints.
Yeah.
And that's not going on with the samadhi follower.
Okay, that's a good answer. Yeah, yeah. Marcy, did you have some thought on that? Anybody else? Okay, I think I got three good answers. I don't know the answer. I just wanted to see if... I've never been able to figure that out, but I think all three of you helped me. So Sam said he could have been coming in with wrong view, and so it's important for him to straighten his view out. And so then he would have to emphasize wisdom to get right view. Bowie said that through his samadhi, he would be inclined to faith, which is a good possibility. And Barbara said he has to develop wisdom. Is that what you said? Yeah. He has to develop wisdom. So the samadhi is, in a way, it's almost could be like a hindrance if it's just emphasized. Yeah, it seems to be a good point that, and this is maybe it's very suggestive about our approach to Buddhism. That, you know, people think, okay, I'm going to enter Buddhism, practice really deep meditation and get very deep samadhi. But for those at relatively early stages, the Buddha doesn't emphasize samadhi that much. But it seems the two points that he's emphasizing, one is faith, because it's faith directed to the Buddha. And that serves as the motivation for somebody to develop the Buddhist path. And then in developing the path, the person has to go on to develop some degree of concentration and especially wisdom. And then the other thing that the Buddha emphasizes is to have the right view or the right understanding. And then on that basis, one practices. So even if one comes into the practice already having some mastery over samadhi, the Buddha isn't going to encourage that more, but rather he'll encourage the right faith through, which is not just blind belief, but using that feeling, that trust in the teaching and that devotion as the motivation for developing the practice to the point one makes a breakthrough. And then for the other, who's more intellectually inclined, emphasizing developing that examination, that investigation, which strengthens wisdom to the point where wisdom enables one to make the breakthrough. Okay, so these are all good points. Okay, so let's just continue. I just want to go through the rest of the sutta rather quickly, because we don't have much time. Okay, so the Buddha is now speaking about these are the seven types of noble persons. The last five are the trainees who still have work to do with diligence. Okay, now we're in paragraph 22, the Buddha says. He makes an important statement. He says, I do not say that final knowledge, liberating knowledge, is achieved all at once. You don't, you know, people hear about Buddhism. I remember when I first became interested in Buddhism, I became attracted. It was through the teaching of Zen Buddhism, through the writings of D.T. Suzuki. Always it was the Satori, the sudden awakening. I thought, wow, sudden awakening. Here, I'm a college student going to Brooklyn College. You know, I would read D.T. Suzuki. I'm walking to school. I think, wow, one of these days the leaf is going to fall down from the tree. Just as I take a step, and boom, sudden awakening. Or I'm in there listening to a lecture on it's history or classics or bioscience 101. Teachers talking about how the evolution of the dinosaurs and dropping off. You there in the third row! Boom! Like a Zen master hitting the disciple with a stick. Wow, sudden awakening! Got it! Yeah, but that. And when we read the early text, it's what? Gradual, not all at once. Gradual training, gradual practice, gradual progress. Not for me. I want sudden awakening. Oops, I lost the place. Okay, so then the Buddha explains how this gradual training takes place. And he goes through different stages. Here, one who has faith in the teacher visits him. When he visits him, he pays respect to him. When he pays respect, he gives ear to listen to the teachings. When he gives ear, having heard the teaching, then he learns the teaching, bears it in mind. Then he examines the meaning of the teaching, When he examines their meaning, he gains a reflective acceptance of the teaching. When he gains a reflective acceptance of the teaching, then this zeal or enthusiasm arises in him. When he gains that enthusiasm, he applies his will. Then he more deeply examines the teaching. He strives. And then by striving, again we have this expression, realizing with the body. He realizes with the body. Again, that shows the intensity or depth of the experience. He realizes with the body the supreme truth and sees it by penetrating it with wisdom. So those are the step-by-step stages up to, I would say, my understanding that penetrating the truth of the teaching with wisdom would represent the breakthrough to stream entry, using the technical language. But this covers like the whole range of practice. Then the Buddha, he's now criticizing those monks. He says, you have failed in all of these respects. So you misguided men have strayed far away. You've lost your way, O monks. You have been practicing the wrong way. Very stern words from the Buddha. How far you misguided men have strayed from this Dhamma and discipline. Okay, then the Buddha makes a statement. He says, there is a four-phrase statement, and when it is recited, a wise man or wise person would quickly understand it. I shall teach it to you. Try to understand it. What's interesting is that what follows, the Buddha doesn't quite make exactly clear what is that four-phrase statement. And so there's some, I would say, a little bit controversy about that. The commentary explains it as the Four Noble Truths, but the sutta doesn't explain the Four Noble Truths. Let's continue. Okay, so when the Buddha says, try to understand it, these monks say, who are we that we could understand the Dhamma? Then the Buddha says, now he's going to criticize these monks again, he says, even with a teacher who is concerned with material things, who's attached to material goods, it wouldn't be proper for his disciples to haggle with him. If we get this, if we like this, we'll do it. If we don't like this, we won't do it. So what should be said when the teacher is the Tathagata, the fully enlightened one, who's utterly detached from material things? Okay, then he says, for a disciple who has faith and is intent on really fathoming the Buddha's teaching, it is natural that he conduct himself thus, that he realize that the Buddha is the teacher, the one who knows. I am just a disciple, I do not know. Then he continues, for a disciple who is intent on fathoming the Buddha's teaching, it is natural that he conduct himself thus. In my opinion, this is the four-phrase statement. Willingly let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain, and let the flesh and blood dry up on my body, but my energy shall not be relaxed so long as I have not attained what can be attained by manly strength, energy, and persistence. Okay, so the way I understand the four phrases, first, willingly let only my skin, sinews, and bones remain. The second, let the flesh and blood on my body dry up. The third, my energy shall not be relaxed. Then the fourth, so long as I have not attained what can be attained by manly strength, energy and persistence. That's my opinion, but maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, this is the advice that the Buddha usually gives to those disciples who have already really well developed, you know, who are just on the point of realization. Like, this was maybe another one of my early mistakes. You know, first year as a monk, you read the sutta, and you think, okay, that's the Buddha's advice. I hear the Buddha speaking personally to me. You know, maybe I'm reading it 7 p.m., 8 p.m. Get on my bed, cross the legs, think, okay, I'm going to let the sinews and bones remain, let the flesh and blood dry up on my body, but I'm not going to uncross my legs till I've realized the goal. Sit down, cross the legs. Then I'm imagining, okay, when those novices come knocking on the door, bringing me my morning breakfast, I'm not even going to answer the door. When lunch comes, I'm not even going to get up and go to the dining hall for lunch. Just going to be sitting here. I could see the rays of light emanating from my body. The novices will know what's going on inside. Okay, 20 minutes go by. Bzz, 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 bzz. Mosquitoes. Okay, one mosquito lands. I'm going to be there. Not going to make a move. I can do it. Let him drink all the blood he wants. And hey, what's going on here? I thought one could take, but not two. Okay, I'm still not going to move. Okay, get away, get away. Okay, now I can sit. Look at the clock. 25 minutes. It's only 8:25. Another 10.5 hours to breakfast, and I'm getting hungry already. Okay. 35 minutes. Pain in the legs. I'm not going to move. Pain, pain, pain. Okay, change the position. Okay, so you get the point that, you know, it's really this kind of teaching is for the advanced practitioner. But for us, we have to build up, you know, gradually and slowly. But always have courage and strength to push oneself a little further. So if you're used to sitting 30 minutes, extend it to 40, then extend to 50, and then if you could extend to sitting even once or twice a day for an hour, that's quite good. Okay, so let's just finish up. Well, actually, the Buddha just... Okay, then he says, for a faithful follower who's practicing in this way, one of two fruits can be expected. Either final knowledge, that's the knowledge of liberation, here and now, or if there's still a trace of clinging left, the stage of non-returner. Okay, unfortunately there is not time for a question and answer session, but we have the regular question and answer after lunch. Now today the kitchen is opened up again, so if you like, you can take lunch in the dining hall, and then we'll meet again at, say, 10 after 12, then we have a question and answers and discussion. So please come back. And if you can't stay, yeah. Yeah, it's out of the Majjhima Nikaya, and you don't have it at home. Yeah, yeah. And there's a schedule on the BAUS, it's the Buddhist Association of the United States website. You just go to their website, then you'll see my name, the Middle Length Discourses class, then you'll see the schedule. The next time, that will be a long time, May 12th, it will be, yeah, 12th is the next class here. It will be on Sutta number 71, and then I'm going to send to people some excerpts from other suttas to balance that one out. If you have not been here before, if you want to get on the mailing list, okay, Johnny will take your email address, contact address, and then every week an announcement is sent out about the time. Well, the time is always the same, about the sutta that we're studying. Okay, so let us end with, we'll do the short form of the sharing of the merits. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanubodhitva chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanubodhitva chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanubodhitva chiram rakantu mam param. Eta hatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya pavagupadaya avijihetato etantare satakayupapana rupi arupi cha asanya sanino tukha pamuchantu pusantu nibutin. Okay, then we stand up and then we end with 3 half-hours to Buddha.